Welcome to the Turnaround Mindset podcast with your hosts, behavioral economist and psychologist Phil Slade and successful business leader and accountant Adam Smith. In these unprecedented times, decisive and fearless leadership is critical to any business transformation. Each week, our hosts will unpack the tough and intimate questions we all face as professionals, offering no-nonsense business advice to those bold enough to think and act differently. Now, here are your hosts, Phil and Adam.
Hi, everyone, and thanks for joining us for our final episode of Season 1, episode 16 of the Turnaround Mindset.
It's been a wild ride.
It has been a wild ride.
We've been through 16 episodes, pretty crazy. Goldilocks, we've been through biking stories, we've shared so much together.
We have, mate, we have. And, you know, look, it's probably fitting that the last topic we talk about today is motivation. And I think it's an important topic, and the main reason it is look, more and more of us are working remotely, and with signs, you know, that COVID's going to be here for some time yet before we actually see some change or transition back to some form of normality. So, you know, business leaders, they're facing new challenges now, Phil. It's relating to keeping employees motivated in their jobs and inspired to serve customers and still deliver their deadlines. Now, motivation, you know, especially in this type of environment, it can be in short supply during times of stress. Mm. Now, management would be easy, Phil, if only everyone were highly motivated.
If only that was the case.
Yeah, exactly. But look, generally, when you find a good manager, good managers, they generally motivate with a company's strategic plan. You know, they've got passion for what they do. And their capacity to rationalize their reasoning and business decisions with their teams and employees, it goes without saying. But, you know, those type of managers, when coupled with bonuses and incentives, you'd like to think theoretically that they're the type of managers that should be able to march their people off in the right direction. The problem is that type of strategy only works with a small portion of employees and, interestingly, only a very small percentage of managers. So why is that? Well, to start with, it's incredibly hard to find executives like Jack Welch or, you know, influential leaders like Nelson Mandela who are innately gifted with the ability to rally the troops into action. Further, things like cash incentives or executive coaching won't generally have an impact long term on the bulk of staff within an organization. Those that do respond to those external gratifications, so to speak, will generally be those who are high performers anyway and are already up and running within your business. It's the rest of the business that remains the problem. Most managers who've been managers for a while know that in management, you have no choice but to deal with all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. But managers know from painful experience that the 80-20 rule applies, and that is the most intractable employees take up a disproportionate amount of one's time and energy. I could think of a few, actually. So how do you get these employees to follow your lead? How do you get them energized and committed in such a way that they not only support your initiatives, but they actually carry them out? So in March this year, I came across a video by Simon Sinek on YouTube. And it was titled, How Do I Motivate the Unmotivated? Where he indicated that we should not assume that a lack of motivation is an intrinsic problem. As leaders, we should first evaluate whether or not we've created an environment that inspires our employees. In order to spark motivation, Simon says, people must feel seen and valued. So on today's podcast, we thought on our last episode, we'd expand on this topic around what our tips are on how to motivate employees and our direct teams. Even the most productive and positive people struggle with a lack of motivation from time to time, especially, as I mentioned, when stress is a factor. No matter how talented or experienced you are, it's not possible to stay driven all the time. If you manage teams, you're bound to encounter team members or even entire teams who suffer from a lack of motivation. So today we ask, how do we motivate the unmotivated, Phil?
Yeah, look, it's a fascinating topic. I mean, obviously, as a psychologist who's spent most of my professional career working within organizations, motivation and managing changes and nuances and new environments and keeping people on track and creating high performance and looking at performance has been a real focus of a lot of what we've done over the years. And motivation is a tricky one because it is you've only got a certain amount of control over other people, and we'll talk about this more later. But I think what you've got to realize is that motivation is not a 100% outcome science. There's no magic pill. It's not like you can do something and 100% of everyone's going to get motivated and get on board. That's a unicorn. Mm-hmm. So what I mean is you're working with degrees of motivation. You're wanting the group or the your employees to become more motivated. And there's no ultimate level of motivation, right? You can get hyper and you can get burnout for people that are workaholics, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about that intrinsic drive to want to do something, work with you and achieve the outcomes that are shared by the group.
Mm-hmm.
But unmotivated people kind of tend to fall into three clumps.
Clumps. Okay.
Clumps. I like to say clumps, right? Because it's kind of visually how it feels, right?
Got it.
You get the first clump of people is that they're unmotivated through apathy or lack of clarity or direction or a general sense of learned helplessness where they've tried in the past and it hasn't worked and it doesn't seem to matter what they do, it doesn't get better. And so they sort of get in this unmotivated sort of apathy, you know?
Yep.
The second clump is they are motivated, but they've just been promoted to their incompetence, right? So they don't have there's a capability gap, which is undermining their performance and the organizational outcomes that you want to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And so they might be motivated, but they're not, they just can't fill that gap.
Mm.
The third clump is that they're actually motivated to not do what you want. So these are the people that have found success in being able to buck the system, that they only want to do what they want to do. They've been able to carve out a set of rules that you don't have the power here, and they're actually motivated to not do what you want to do.
Mm.
So when talking about motivating unmotivated people, we're really wanting to increase the performance of the underperforming. That's essentially what we're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is possible for the first group where you've got the unmotivated through apathy or lack of clarity, you know, because you're needing to just give clarity, direction, incentives, and responsibility, right? The second group may never have the ability to reach the required expectations. No matter how much you motivate them, they just won't achieve the outcomes that you need as leaders. But they will likely thrive in a different role in the company.
Mm.
However, the third are much harder bucket or clump, as we say, to move, right?
Yep.
And it's likely the effort to move this last clump of people is unlikely to match the increase in utility you will ever receive from that individual relative to the effort that you'll need to put in.
Mm.
People need to want to be better in order to be better. That's the intrinsic thing. So if you're dealing with this last clump of people, you've got only a few levers that you can pull. And this becomes really difficult when you can't move them on, right?
Yep.
But some people are just simply not going to come around, and that's just part of the matrix of unmotivated people.
Yep.
What our job as leaders and managers is to create the circumstances in which their inherent motivation, the natural commitment and drive that most people have, is freed and channeled towards achievable goals.
Hmm.
Because if you're reaching your outcomes, if people are achieving what they need to achieve, you apparently don't have a motivation problem, right? So this is it's always in the context of outcomes and organizational outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
So first and foremost, you need to be cognizant of what you can and cannot control. You can influence other people by the way that you respond to them in situations, but you cannot control them.
Got it.
And controlling what you can control is your words and actions and the environment that they sit. I think the Simon Sinek is right, and that you can create situations and environments that nudge people towards certain behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
But it's only nudges. You're working in degrees of motivation. They still control their words and actions to a large extent. At a basic level, people need to want to move in order for themselves to move.
Mm.
As well as this, people are basically motivated by getting what they want or avoiding what they don't want. You know, mm-hmm. I think I often say to people, if somebody walks in with a gun and puts it in your mouth, you're motivated to do something, right? That's mm-hmm. an external motivator. And even if you don't want to get off the couch, right then you go, I might get off the couch here because you're motivated to do so. Now, I don't suggest anyone motivating with brute force like that is a good long-term solution. But we are responding to our environment, right? We are reactive. Motivation does come from inside a person, but the motivators and the stresses that produce behavioral responses often do come from external sources.
No, I totally get that. Look, I've seen it many times before. You know, managers and leaders believe that they can motivate those problem employees by saying things like, you know, if I can only get this person to listen, he'll see the logic of what I'm saying, you know. And the error here is the false belief that people have the same thought process as we do and will eventually see the error in their ways. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, look, each of us have a profile of motivational drivers, values and biases influence our ideas about what is reasonable and the logic of our logic. You know, it does change between us. But the fundamental rule of management is that you can't change people's character. Mm. You can't even control their actions most of the time. Change comes from within or not at all. So the question is always about how do you change the environment to create an environment where that change will come from within and people make that decision by themselves. So on today's episode, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about 5 tips because we love a good list.
Absolutely.
On Turnaround Mindset. We always love a good list. 5 tips around motivating the unmotivated.
Mm-hmm.
I think before we start, it is worth noting something, and that is that everyone has motivational energy for something.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, we'd do nothing at all, ever. Right? Yep, so we've all got motivational energy, although many problem employees display a lack of drive and commitment to their jobs, and these qualities are usually alive and well in other areas of their lives as well. It's never really just limited to their job. So part of what we're talking about here today is something that Nigel Nicholson of the Harvard Business Review refers to as a new approach to motivation. It involves shifting the responsibility for motivation from subject to object, right? From boss to subordinate. It's about making sure that the responsibility for doing things and the decision rights moves down the line.
Mm.
Crucially, it also involves a shift in perspective.
Yep.
This manager needs to look at the employee not as a problem to be solved, but as a person to be understood and unlocked.
Mm. Well, that's really interesting, mate. Look, I think a lack of motivation within a company eventually leads to all the other stuff as well. You know, you're talking about increases in absenteeism, there's also conflict and also turnover of employees. It's a vicious cycle, you know. But when one team member isn't motivated to do their work, it does affect others as they start to become mentally and emotionally depleted due to the constant exposure to that sort of negativity, or just as you called it, bucking the system, you know. But eventually the lack of motivation will reach your customers through poorer service or lower quality products. So look, I'm super keen to get into these tips, but before we do, look, what we're actually talking about here for our listeners is not always going to lead to a solution to motivation, but they're actually designed to create resolution, right, around motivating those that are just unmotivated.
That's right. This is a more nuanced topic than do these 5 things and all of a sudden you'll have a motivated
Absolutely
employee right.
Base, right? You might resolve the situation. It may not be the solution you originally thought of, but is actually going to move you towards a common ground and hopefully a better understanding of what to do next.
So this should start a good conversation. And if you want to continue this, and this is why people like me, like basically dedicate their lives to looking at what motivates people and how people can make better decisions than they are, it's because it is complex, you know. So don't beat yourself up if you're having trouble. Most managers do have trouble with this, and this is a common thing. It often can feel like you're the only one when you're in that situation, and you look at other teams and you can't see the challenges that they see, and so you think it's more for yourselves. There's a sort of an actor observer bias going on there. But anyway, number one, because we love a good list, number one for motivating the unmotivated is to remove the blocks. You know, one of the most common blockages occur when people or employees feel that their bosses don't care about them. This makes catch-up pep talks about improving performance generally falling on deaf ears or coming across as really insincere.
It's like, you don't get me, that type of thing.
Correct. Yeah. So to remove that block means you've got to trust and rely on employee participation, right? They've got to know that you genuinely care about them, not just about the outcomes.
Gotcha.
Right? This means finding the person's source of energy and leveraging it to achieve the goals you are trying to achieve, instead of pushing solutions on people that will force with the force of your argument. You know, it's all about trying to pull solutions out of them or getting them
to... So putting it back on them is what you're saying.
Well, yep. Putting it back on them, but also understanding what... you've got organizational goals. They've got individual goals, right? Mm. And what the big trick is you're trying to by caring for them, you go, I understand what you want to achieve. How can we achieve what you want to achieve and what the organization wants to achieve together? And that conversation is a partnering conversation, which you can then create a strategy and then start to implement and do some solid, tangible actions out of that sort of conversation.
Mm.
But it turns the tables, right? Turns the tables and gets employees' attention at the very least. It prompts them to clear the obstacles that are impeding their motivation, primarily because by achieving the organizational goals, they also achieve their goals. And so they're motivated to do what you need to do for a personal gain, not just for an organizational gain.
Yeah, okay. So I guess what you're saying is that this type of method, you know, requires patience because you're basically making an investment, you know, with yourself and with the employee you're having trouble with. You know, what I mean is that, you know, because you're looking for them to suggest a solution and why things haven't worked until now. So rather than trying to convince the employee yet again why they need to improve performance, you're putting it back on them to help drive the outcome.
Mm.
I'm guessing a fair amount of empathy is required around this as well, or involved in actually getting to a resolution with the employee.
Yeah, absolutely. And this can be harder than what that sounds, right? Particularly if you're frustrated at the underperformance and you come to that person thinking that they're a complete tool, you know, like really, like, and you often, as a high performer, if you're a high performer and you see underperformance, it can be very hard to see that person as a human. You just see that person as a blocker to you achieving your goals, right? So empathy and genuine empathy for the person is crucial in that state, and you've got to come with that mindset. But so, and what empathy does is it allows you and the employee to see a path towards a common goal that you've set.
No, I like that one. All right, so number two, and I think it follows very well after number one, and that is get to know your employees. Mm. Now, look, I think it's a common mistake for managers across the board on this one. Like, I'll think of an example. We're talking about clumps, are we? So let's call this employee Phil Clump, you know, and he's struggling to improve his performance, you know. You sit down, you have a series of chats with him, and in the end, the decision's made to let Phil Clump leave the business because things aren't working out. But then once the person's left, you find out there was a whole heap of personal circumstances going on, and the person just didn't feel comfortable enough to either be vulnerable about this situation or just to be able to speak openly with their manager.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, you've actually lost an employee who may have been, through the right discussions, conversations, etc., capable of staying on and being motivated within that company.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do generally is, you know, with problem employees or people who are unmotivated in the sense of what we want to achieve within the business, you know, they're taken through the usual appraisal routines and management discussions, and then they're dismissed, you know. But what we're saying is if you get to know your employees, it requires more indirect investigations, which actually might lead to a different outcome. So to have any hope of effectively motivating, you have to understand something about your employees and why they aren't working up to their potential.
Mm.
And the first step, you know, requires a manager to work out where a problem employee is coming from. What drives that person? What blocks those drives? What might happen if the impediments were removed? And, you know, a test of this would be asking problem employees just to describe themselves. You know, how do you describe yourself in this business? You know, what is it you do? How do you do it? And a lot of employees who've become so caught up with, oh, I'm just not favored here. My boss doesn't recognize anything that I do. I just am totally unmotivated. When you actually put it back on them to say, well, you know, describe yourself. What do you do? It almost a certainty that they would use different words from the ones you might use. So, you know, this isn't just about asking people directly, but have multiple confidential conversations with the colleagues who know these people well and might be able to provide you some perspective. You know, what is it that they, you know, is standing between ability and execution? What are their likes, dislikes, their hopes and fears? The more you know, the better chance you'll have of discovering what incentivizes or what the incentives are that can in fact be, you know, difference makers for that particular employee.
Understanding the employees and knowing those blockers will also allow you to know which clump are they in. Are they just the apathy clump? Are they the you know, beyond their capability clump, or are they just actually motivated to not do what you're going to do? And you know, you're not going to know that from the outside. You're going to need to pick under the surface. You know,
yeah.
It's also about saying, as a manager or a leader yourself, that you need to acknowledge the context with which the problem is occurring.
Yeah.
Right? You need to look at your own role in the problem that you've been trying to solve, especially because direct bosses are the most potent source of employee dissatisfaction and the chief reason people quit their jobs, right? This method requires a bit of soul searching because it means you need to involve. And we like to call this a trust circle, right? You've got a trust circle between your direct line and your employees. And people will stay in a job and work in a job in an organization where they disrespect to a degree the leadership if they've got a really strong trust circle. Now, I'd obviously, ideally, you want the trust circle to be at every level of the organization, and so it cascades down and you get good culture throughout the organization. But if that trust circle is broken, it doesn't matter how good the organization is, those employees are likely to leave.
Now, look, it's give and take. It means, you know, you've got to be grown up enough to say that maybe the management style that I'm employing may not necessarily be the right one for this employee, but to know what style will work comes about through, as I said, those conversations, getting to know the staff that work with you. Because if you can break out of this narrow mindset, you're most likely to get the employee to perform better. And you'll probably rethink what you wanted to achieve with this problem employee in the first place.
And I often think, you know, it's you know, when I was talk about blaming other people, when we talk about biases, I often talk about the story about crossing the road. And growing up, I learned a rule that you look, you know, you look right if there's a car coming or not, you start crossing the road, and then you look left and then you keep crossing the road. And then I went to America and for the first time and I ran out in the road. I was so excited that I looked right, stepped out in the road and almost got taken out by a bus on the left because the context changed, but I didn't. And I then got angry at the bus. And that's often what happens is when something doesn't work because it's worked in the past and it's kept us safe and helped us thrive in the past, we apply that in a different situation where our instinct is to blame everyone else because our history tells us that it's worked in the past, therefore you're the problem. And having that ability to first pause and go, okay, do I need to evolve and change my mindset in this situation quickly before assuming that it's always the other person's problem is really, really important. And this flexibility leads on to number three, because you also need to, you know, number three is to stay flexible, not just within yourself, but also in setting goals. You know, first and foremost, it's important as a manager that you state clearly your own expectations on a project. Remember, this is about underperformance and not reaching expected outcomes. So setting those expectations really clearly is really important, right? Rule number one in business, you don't get something for nothing. In return for your own thoughtful attention to your employees' well-being and success, there are definable expectations you'll have. One key to effective management is to directly confront the hard stuff, which is why it's important to make clear exactly what your performance-related expectations are and be comfortable holding people to account. You know,
absolutely,
what's acceptable and what isn't. And an unmotivated subpar performance naturally isn't. You know, that's what it is. Like, clarity is always the ally of strong performance. If you aren't getting motivation from employees or the behavior you expect around these goals you have set, it might mean goals need to be reframed to get the outcome sought. It might mean that just because it's a goal that you would achieve as working a 24-hour-a-day workaholic is an unrealistic expectation on someone else too, right? You've got to be flexible with those things. The worst thing that can happen is that when employees push back, frustrated with the outcome the manager wants, This leads to gossip, procrastination, and unnecessary intention within the office climate, because that's learned helplessness, right?
Yep.
People are learning that it doesn't matter what I do, I'm never going to live up to your expectations.
Yep.
And you're always going, no matter, I'll work really hard, and then you're going to burn me with fire for not achieving those unrealistic expectations, right?
Yep.
So you need to be really careful about making sure that those expectations are achievable and nuanceable. And sometimes it's about, that they might be doing 10 widgets a day and then you need to do 100 widgets a day. You might need to go, hey, let's see if we can do 15. Let's see if we can do 20. Let's see if we can do 50. Hey, maybe we can do 100, you know, and then they end up going, well, they start believing that they can do what they otherwise didn't believe. But that's a change management process, right?
Yeah.
It's easier just to say, I've told him what needs to be done. Why can't they just do it?
Yeah, why can't they?
You know, just do it. I've told you what you need to do. You're competent. You're being hired to do a job. You're being paid to do the job. So do what you're being paid for or go get out, you know. That's never going to end well,
no.
That sort of attitude, right? You'd be better served if you let go of your desire to bring a motivated employee to justice and instead determine what can be gained from rehabilitating a wayward one. You will be more effective if you are willing to switch from your predetermined solution to an array of possible outcomes with an individual.
Yeah, so you're pivoting.
Pivoting. You're basically stopping. You know, both you and I are a bit like this when we create a strategy and create roles that people need to fit in that strategy and then try to jam people into those roles.
Mm-hmm.
And what this is saying is you also need to say, hey, what are the talents that sit within our group in order to build on the strengths of that group in order to achieve that role? And both approaches are correct. You know, too much reliance on one or the other is not right. But by being clear needing to have that empathy and understanding and staying flexible in the goals that you're setting or the way that you achieve those goals means that people get a sense of ownership, they find that responsibility and they feel like it's achievable, right? So a willingness to be flexible in your aims can also yield novel and ambitious alternatives you may not have even considered.
Like that.
You know, this is you starting to draw on the collective genius. In the end, you may not get exactly what you wanted from that employee, but you'll certainly get more than you did before, and sometimes outcomes that are actually better for the organization than the ones that you were trying to push for in the first place.
Okay, Mr. Klump, number four, and this relates to...
Sorry, Goldilocks.
And this relates to personal and team dynamics. You know, I heard of a wonderful saying once, and that's, show me your friends and I'll show you your future.
Yeah.
And look, generally what I've observed, you know, with dissatisfied employees, you know, it can sometimes be more about the company that they keep. And that's about the characters or the people within their workplace relationships, you know, the ones that they deal with day to day. You know, it can make a massive difference between frustration and engagement, disengagement and productivity. You know, what I'm saying here is that team composition matters. If you've got a really optimistic, really positive group, but you've got a series of other people that may be negative, a bit more unmotivated, the whole thing, it brings the whole group dynamic down. You know, and it's one of those things where for a given project, pairing an employee with someone they enjoy and work well with is massively beneficial to the company, as opposed to someone whom, for whatever reason, they just don't get along with. You know, it can be as I said, a constructive catalyst. You know, I understand, of course, managers don't always have that flexibility, but I think if you're trying to drive better outcomes, you're trying to actually motivate people, you've got to surround themselves with people who they like working with. Mm. And it just might be the wrong group working with someone who's better suited, as you said earlier, somewhere else in the organization. They may be better placed with that group. They might have the same beliefs, fundamentals, ideals, whatever it happens to be that motivates them on a daily basis. So when formulating up teams to deliver projects or execute, you know, improve performance initiatives, whatever it happens to be, you've got to make sure that you actually set these people up for success. As I mentioned, you know, whatever people you surround yourself with will generally be the result or the outcome that actually is generated for that project.
Well, we're herd animal. We have a herd instinct as human beings, right? And the biggest fallacy, I think, that often gets banded around is that if I can change your attitudes, then your behaviors will change. But when you're around people, what happens is that you will align your behaviors to what is acceptable to the people that are around you, to the group expectations, to the norms of that group.
Yep.
And then your attitudes actually... through a thing called cognitive dissonance, which is, you know, the pain that you have when your behavior and your attitude don't match, what will happen is that your attitudes will shift and change to align with your behavior.
Mm.
And so if the biggest influence of a behavior is the herd, then you've got to surround yourself with the people that have the same sort of attitude as you in order to, or the attitude that you want, or surround people, others, with people who have got a similar attitude so that you can see them change and give them the ability to change. We're all herd animals, right? So behavior changes attitudes, which, you know, I find exciting, which leads us to our number five, which is find exciting projects, right? Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Like if you're excited about something, you're going to be motivated to do it, right?
Absolutely.
I'm excited about psychology, and so I'm going to be motivated to go and spend 10 years of my life studying this damn thing and you know, writing books and stuff. Like, there is a motivation there because I find it exciting. I'm curious. I'm naturally curious, you know? And you know, without that level of excitement, of that wonder that sits out there with what you're doing, you're never going to find that motivation. So you've got to prod that curious motivation that sits in everyone. Everyone's got that, right? Everyone's got a little kid that just wants to look under the rock, right? And so you've got to find out what that is, you know? If you find the right match that sparks an employee's interest, the results can be... it's really surprising and exceptional. Like, this has been the thing that has often turned average employees into high performers, is finding it exciting.
Yeah.
So the key thing is, how do you do that? How do you find what's exciting to them? You ask them.
Absolutely.
Ask them what do you find exciting? What attracted to you to this role in the first place? In a way, it's the same thing that you do in a lot of marriage counseling. When people have found their marriages less exciting, the motivation to keep the relationship going starts to wane. So they often come into trouble. So one of the first things you do in marriage counseling is saying, well, what attracted you in the first place? What was exciting back then? These are the same people. Can you find that excitement again and find that passion, that value, that when I want to be a part of this organization? Now, sometimes it's just, well, I had an opportunity and I created the opportunity. Well, what about that opportunity? Keep digging, ask the why, and you will find where that little nugget of excitement is, and then work with that.
Absolutely.
Fan that flame, you know, so that you will translate excitement into motivation. Mm. It'll also mean that it sort of has a circular effect on that first point, which is build empathy and understand, you know, it makes people feel heard.
Yep.
And they you get me, you understand me, and therefore it works against learned helplessness, it wards against all of those sorts of things that are really blocking the unmotivated. Mm. So, you know, what we've left this as the last point, but I think it's one of the most crucial.
Yeah. Well, look, I think it's one of those things where if you're a part of a big organization and you've been working on a project or whatever it might be for a long time, it becomes a scenario where you've almost got yourself stuck in a rut, right? So what I've found, you know, in my career especially, is sitting down and creating what you'd call a career plan for a lot of those employees coming through the business, because you've actually got to ask, you've been working in XYZ for a long time now. Is it something that you want to keep doing, or are you actually interested in doing something else with your career? I think when you're, as we said before, being able to put it back onto the employee that's actually causing the rift or is actually butting against what you're trying to achieve, by giving them, to a certain extent, the power to drive their own motivation, tell them, you know, what is it you want to do? It's going to work for everyone. It's always going to be a scenario where you'll generate better outcomes by putting it back on that person to say, well, what is the career that you want?
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to focus on? What are the areas in the business that still are of interest to you?
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of just helps to set up a completely different tone for your discussions with those employees. Well, I hate to say it, Phil, we've come to the end of what I would say is our last list for season one. And that's our 5 tips towards motivating the unmotivated. So let's step through them really quickly once again. Number 1, remove the blocks. Number 2, really get to know your employees, the context within which they work, the circumstances around who they are and what they do. Number 3, stay flexible in setting goals. Number 4, recognize the importance of personal and team dynamics, aka show me your friends and I'll show you your future. And finally, for the very excited Mr. Klump beside me here, find exciting projects. Now, as always, the tips we talked about here, they can be time-consuming, trust me, I know, difficult and fraught with risks sometimes, with setbacks, etc. Although, you know, some employees may respond really quickly to some of today's tips, others might require time to rebuild positive relationships with you and their work. But in the end, what's important for us and for our listeners is that at least those former unmotivated employees will be heading in the right direction, powered to a certain extent by their own steam.
Yeah, look, it's a bit sad that we've come to the end.
It is.
It's been 16 episodes of, it's been an amazing journey. I think we are going to come back, though. This is
absolutely
not the end of the story, but we're going to change tack slightly when we come back. So when we come back, this first season has been all about pulling apart some of our personal experiences and our stories and what we've learned over the years of time working within organisations, both as I would call you a forensic accountant, really, not just accountant and leader, as well as an organisational psychology buff and behavioural economist, right? So, but what we're also interested in is other people's stories. So what we're going to do in season 2 is get other people that have got great stories of turning around either themselves or other organizations. And we're going to share those stories and we're going to have a conversation with them so that we can learn through their experience, which I think is really super exciting. Mm. So season 2, we'll see a bit of a shift in the way that we're doing these podcasts. But we know that if you've enjoyed this podcast, then you will really enjoy season 2 as it comes around in the near future. But remember, if you like this podcast, please subscribe to the Turnaround Mindset wherever you get your podcasts and leave a 5-star rating. As always, don't forget to share this podcast with someone whom you think will benefit from it. And like always here at the Turnaround Mindset, I would like to finish with a quote from poet Mary Oliver. Not that we always finish with Mary Oliver.
Not
we
Mary.
Finish with a quote.
With a quote, yeah.
This one's from Mary. And this is Mary's quote. She did say, "The most regretful people on earth are those who felt the call to creative work, who felt their own creative power restive and uprising, and gave to it neither the power nor time." See you when we're back in season 2.
See you, Phil.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Turnaround Mindset podcast. If you liked what you heard today, please head over to iTunes, Google, or Spotify, hit subscribe, and share the podcast with someone you think would benefit from it. Don't forget to leave a 5-star rating. To download this episode and access other relevant content, please visit our website, www.theturnaroundmindset.com. Join us next week for another Turnaround Mindset episode, and remember, the only way it gets better for you is when you get better.